This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And David Vihil.
Hello.
And joining us from our office in Ontario, Canada, is Abe Blondeau.
Good day.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Israel, we've got Brent Noctegal.
Good to be with you.
Well, Russia's illegal war on Ukraine is now in its eighth day, and it is dramatically intensifying, with Russia now increasingly using aerial bombardment and missile launchers to destroy civilian targets in key cities. To bring us up to speed on this, we'll go to Abe Blondeau.
Yeah, this week, we're starting to see a transition in the Russian strategy in Ukraine. And what the transition is from appeared to be a fast decapitation attack aimed at removing the Ukrainian leadership, hitting key infrastructure, and it's moving towards a more systematic conquest of the entirety of Ukraine. Some plans were captured. They were posted on the Ukrainian foreign minister's Facebook page. So that's a somewhat reliable source of information, but The Russian plans show they had a 12-day war planned initially, but as has been seen, Ukraine has put up a much better fight than what was anticipated. So, and this makes sense if we kind of take a step back from the mainstream media talking points for a second. No one's really been talking about how Ukraine is one of the largest and best equipped armies in Europe. They may not have all the larger technological weapons that other nations have, but they do have, I believe it is, if not the largest, one of the largest amount of men in the army. They also have a large amount of equipment supplied from the United States, such as drones and anti-tank missiles, these sort of things, which are very effective. So it would make sense they put up a good fight, but as these high-tech weapons run out and as the Russians start using some of their tools they haven't used yet, it's easy to see how this could turn on a dime very quickly. Just in preparing for the show, I was trying to think of a famous Russian battle that was won through maneuver, and I couldn't think of any. Because most of the time, Russian battles are won through firepower and attrition, not through maneuver. So this is just, If we use history as a guide, it helps bring some clarity into the situation. But just to recap where we are right now in the war quickly, there are four fronts currently in Ukraine. There's a southern front coming from Crimea, which is the fastest moving. It seems to be the most effective front for the Russians. There's an eastern front in the breakaway regions. There's a northern front attacking Kharkiv, which is the second largest city. And then there's a separate column that's going straight for Kiev, the capital city. This week, Russia achieved air supremacy, so that will give them a key advantage, even though they haven't really used their air force very much so far. Another development, as you mentioned, was increasing in their use of artillery and rocket attacks on population centers, especially in Kharkiv. But even this has been very restrained. This attack has been still using just a fraction of what Russia can actually do. And I think the biggest development so far was Russia captured the key city of Kherson in the south. And this gives them a good launch pad to help attack Odessa, which is just a few miles to the west. It's the first major city captured by Russian forces. So there are more peace talks. They agreed to allow corridors for humanitarian aid, but nothing any more significant. And I think what we're seeing play out here is that there's definitely behind the hot war, there's an information war going on where you have Russia claiming one set of facts, Ukraine and the mainstream media claiming another side of facts. For example, Russia claims they've had 500 troops killed. Ukraine says there's 5,000. So it's very difficult to actually know what's going on the ground. And it will just take more time for the true information to be verified.
So I think that not many analysts, predicted that in the event of a full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine, that there would be such robust resistance from the Ukrainians. Putin had hoped, as you said, that the Ukrainian government would flee without much of a fight in just a few days, and that he could install a puppet government, and it would be settled very quickly. But of course, that's not how it's gone. And besides just Ukrainian resistance, we're also seeing an increasingly unified Europe, and even a somewhat resurgent NATO, as you mentioned, with the U.S. offering all kinds of weaponry to the Ukrainians. So I wonder, do you think this was a miscalculation by Putin? Was he totally taken off guard by this?
I think he was counting on a quick victory, maybe the element of surprise in some ways to put the Ukrainians off balance and then have a quick victory. But I think they did have contingency plans for more systematic war. And just based on, you can't mobilize the kind of firepower and men as quickly as Russia has. So they must have had plans to do this. And I think some of the tools they haven't used just shows that they have more plans, and they're just waiting for the right time to unleash them in the war.
Yes. So Putin may have miscalculated the tenacity of the Ukrainian resistance a bit, and also the scale of the West's assistance, but it doesn't mean that he was unprepared for any of that. What's your view on how long he's willing to stay the course in this invasion?
Yeah, I think that's probably the key question everyone's wondering now, and I think he's going to stay until Ukraine is conquered. As your article on thetrumpet.com points out, I think that's the only option, and I think Putin has weighed the risks, and he knows that the fruits of victory outweigh all the costs of the war he's in right now. And I think very quickly Putin could conquer Ukraine, despite what we've seen. I think it would lead to more civilian casualties, more worldwide condemnation what he did. But if he captures Odessa, that's a key. I think that would turn the war around, because that would strangle Ukraine's economy. And if he did use just indiscriminate bombing of cities, even cyber attacks to cripple Ukrainian infrastructure and their ability to communicate with the outside world, I think you could see Russia very brutally subdue Ukraine very quickly. But I think that's just a sign of where we are right now in the world.
Yes. Yeah. He's really put just a great deal on the line here. And I think it's hard to envision any scenario in which he decides that the costs are too high and reconsiders. And then we also know that Putin has a tried and true strategy of conquering cities. We've seen this in both Chechnya and Syria, where he used missile strikes and bomb detonations in residential neighborhoods. You know, that does destroy infrastructure, but it also terrorizes civilians into fleeing. And then, of course, the Russian ground forces can advance into the city. So it looks like this is the approach that we can probably expect more of in Ukraine soon. So just a tragic and terrifying nightmare that is unfolding there. Abe, can you place this in the context of Bible prophecy for us, and also just let listeners know what they could read in order to better understand that?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the details of the war, we can't predict or really know what's going to happen. But if we take a step back, Bible prophecy does show us, I think, the ultimate outcome of the invasion of Ukraine. And Ezekiel 37-38, and what Mr. Editor-in-Chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has written in the literature, shows that Putin will emerge as one of the world leaders of these Gentile power blocks that will dominate the world in the years leading up to Christ's return. So if we look at the broad overview, it appears that whatever happens in the war in Ukraine, Putin will emerge stronger than before the conflict began. And one of the sidebars of this is you will see closer Russian and Chinese cooperation. And you're seeing these power blocks form in the world. You have Europe forming. You have Russia, China going closer together, and then you have America looking increasingly isolated. And that's exactly what Bible prophecy said would happen. And if for readers who want to dive into this and look into more details, Jeremiah has an article up on thetrumpet.com, Putin Can't Afford to Lose Ukraine. And that's a great article that just will give more details and prophetic significance of what we're seeing in Ukraine.
Putin Can't Afford to Lose Ukraine is the name of that article. We'll include a link to that in the show notes for today's episode. Thanks very much for that, Abe. We'll take a look now at some of the effects that Russia's invasion is having on Germany. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote about this earlier this week, and he quoted one analyst calling it the most dramatic political shift in modern German history. And Mr. Fleury said it means, quote, German militarism is back. So just a bombshell development, and Richard Palmer did cover this on the March 2nd episode of Trumpet Hour, but more has unfolded since then. So to learn the latest on this, we'll go to David Vihil.
Thank you, Jeremiah. Yes, the news is calling Germany's transformation multiple things, a radical U-turn, a 180-degree change, a turning point. So you just see how there's been a very big change in Germany's approach to the military because of this invasion, which we've heard so much about already. I think one of the interesting things about this is it just shows human nature and how that humans, if they're faced with a foreign threat, can unite and face that threat. And you see that in Europe right now. You see the EU and Europe united in their desire and approach to boost their military spending. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz announced that they're going to increase their spending on the military more than 2% economic output, which is quite a big jump in the spending. He's also announced they're immediately going to add 100 billion euros towards military investments immediately. So you see them taking the lead in the spending here. It's going to let them spend more money than even Russia does on the military and put them basically at the world's third largest military spender. Now, that's just Germany. When you include potentially the other military investments from Europe, you can get pretty close to maybe even matching China in the future. But what you see is more than just talk. More recently, you see some actions being taken by Germany in order to bolster the defense of Europe, and even if it's just a symbolic thing, it just shows Germany's leadership here. For example, there's a report that they moved 3 Eurofighters from a German base into Romania. Romania is a nation that borders Ukraine on the southwest. So you see that they are basically sending a signal to Russia not to go any further than Ukraine. That report came from a German news source, Tagesschau. There is also a report that the German Air Force announced, and this was actually from Twitter, that they're transferring some German pilots to Poland to help secure the Polish airspace. So once again, you have some leadership there. I think that announcement in Twitter, the translation of the hashtag used was stronger together. Once again, showing this unity in this threat that they're all facing. And it's not just the Air Force. There's also some mobilization in the Army as well. They're sending 350 soldiers to Lithuania and the Baltic states there as well. And just shows, once again, that they're sending a signal of strength to Russia. But more importantly, you see that it's Germany taking the leadership in this military role. These nations are welcoming the increase of German troops on their soil. And they're celebrating the fact that Germany has made this transformation, this U-turn, and are now, as Mr. Gerald Fleury said, remilitarizing here. Even when German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier went to Lithuania there, he told the press there, quote, "Alliance solidarity applies without ifs and buts. My trip is an expression of solidarity and assistance." And I would also add, too, that it's also a expression of leadership.
And this is it's really pushing forward some key Bible prophecies that the Trumpet has been discussing for years.
Yeah, actually, you know, what's really interesting about this was Mr. Joe Fleury, our editor-in-chief, he actually filmed a Key of David just a week and a half before Russia invaded Ukraine. And he was building that program on how the German Society for Foreign Relations was saying that in order for Germany to take leadership, they would need to spend about 120 billion euros on its military. And that was just a week and a half before the invasion. The invasion occurs, and now you have this announcement from their chancellor saying that they're going to throw in 100 billion euros right now and then spend more than 2% of their economic output, like we discussed before. So it's pretty incredible how Bible prophecy just really lays out the details that are coming out. More specifically, you talked about the article from Gerald Fleury that came out on thetrump.com. Germany responds to Russia with an explosive announcement. And I would just highly recommend any of the listeners to go and read that. It has some wonderful information about what's going on. And more importantly, it points you to all the major Bible prophecies about that and future literature. So that's what I would recommend everyone reading right now if they haven't already. Germany responds to Russia with an explosive announcement. And just realizing that this is exactly the kind of thing that Gerald Fleury has been talking about on the trumpet and on the Key of David. And you just have some proof right there just a week and a half before this invasion occurred.
Well, thanks very much for that, David. We will be sure to include a link to that in the show notes. And Germany is not just shoring up its relationships with Poland and Lithuania and other European countries. This week, it also announced a significant upgrade in its partnership with Israel. For this, we'll go to Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, it was somewhat surprising, actually, this week to travel through the center of town and see all the roads being blocked off and actually German military around. I was not expecting, given the week that we've seen, to see the German chancellor here in Jerusalem. And yet he had a visit Tuesday, Wednesday, I believe, and he was meeting, Mr. Olaf Scholz was meeting with Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. He had a visit to Yad Vashem as well, the Holocaust Museum here in Jerusalem. And obviously this is happening in the backdrop of what's happening in Ukraine and all of Germany's announcements last Sunday with their increase in military spending, etc. And here he was, that he did not want to derail this visit to Israel. This was a meeting that was planned ahead of this Ukraine crisis. And yet what was happening in Europe was not enough to derail this visit. That's how important the Germans see this relationship with Israel. And so at a joint press conference on Wednesday, Naftali Bennett announced that the two had agreed on a creation of a new strategic cooperation between the State of Israel and Germany. This will be in the format of biannual dialogue on security and diplomatic matters. So as of it stands right now, I think they have like a joint cabinet session between their two governments, the German government, the Israeli government, when their ministers come down and they discuss things for a couple of days, once or twice a year, which is already just a really... It's the one country they do this outside of the EU, Germany, that is. But now it's about defense as well and security as well. Bennett said that this is a significant upgrade in our relations. And so he was down here discussing this, his visit, Scholz's visit to Yad Vashem. He put this inside the guest book at Yad Vashem. He wrote this: the crime against humanity that was the Shoah, or the Holocaust, gave the world a glimpse into the abyss. The mass murder of the Jews was instigated by Germany. It was planned and carried out by Germans. Consequently, every German government bears permanent responsibility for the security of the State of Israel and the protection of Jewish life. Never will we forget the suffering of millions and the victims. And so if you're an Israeli looking at this, you would see German leader really elevating the relationship with Israel even further, coming off, you know, two decades of Merkel's close relationship with Israel. And I think many are enjoying the support that the German chancellor is showing.
So you mentioned that this upgrade in Germany-Israel ties comes amid the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And it's hard not to mention the nation of Israel right now without addressing its failure to fully condemn Russia's invasion, its failure to join in any of the Western sanctions against Russia. I know that's a bit of a tangent to what you're mentioning here, but what do you make of that?
Well, I think it's worth discussing, and I think it has everything to do with Israel recognizing a weakened United States in the Middle East, and they have been working with Russia in terms of coordinating its strikes against Iranian assets inside Syria. And so Russia owns the skies inside Syria, and so every time Israel wants to go and bomb a Iranian target, the Russians allow them to do that. And this is essential to stop Iran from arming people on the Syrian border and the Lebanese border. And so they work together. And so Israel's walking a tight line here. If they come on strong against Ukraine or against Russia in support of Ukraine, then Russia might say, that's it, you're done bombing Iranian targets. And so that's probably why it's hard. It is interesting to see this. Israel, they've sent a lot of aid they've sent plane loads of people to help out the Ukrainian situation, the humanitarian situation. But Israel is not going to go all in and condemning Russia in this because their own security, because they recognize that Russia holds the key to Syria right now, it's very dangerous for them. And they're trying to give themselves an out by playing the middle role. I mean, Bennett is calling Putin several times this week, calling the leader of Ukraine several times this week. The Ukrainian leader wants more from Israel. There's been talk about how mediation efforts between the two could be hosted in Jerusalem between Ukraine and Russia here as soon as next week. So we'll see. Israel's trying to play the middle road in this. But in terms of biblical prophecy, we know that Russia isn't going to feature too much in terms of Israel's relationship with Russia, but more Germany itself does play a massive role in the future of Israel. That's why we wanted to draw attention to this, because the Germans, even though Russia's invading Europe, the Germans feel like they need to maintain a close ties with Israel. And even Israelis, there was a study that came out this week that said that 50% of Israelis would actually welcome German mediating efforts in terms of its relationship with Arab states and the peace process. And so Israel is right now warming ties to Germany than I would say any time in the past 70 years. And biblical prophecy says it's going to be a dangerous thing going forward. There's a specific prophecy mentioned in Hosea chapter 5 and verse 13 that talks about how when Israel is facing dangers or biblical Judah, it's going to turn to Germany for help. And yet Germany is not going to be able to solve the problem for them. We actually expect, based on Bible prophecy, a big German double cross coming in the future. But directly before that are closer, warmer, even strategic military ties between Israel and the German state.
Is there any literature that you would point listeners to if they'd like to better understand that this development in the prophetic context?
Yeah, for sure. I think Jerusalem in Prophecy, the Jerusalem Prophecy booklet is a great place to go to get that prophecy in context from Hosea.
We'll be sure to include a link in our show notes to Jerusalem in Prophecy. Thanks very much for that, Brent. We will turn our attention now to the United States, where President Joe Biden has just delivered his first State of the Union address. So we'll turn now to Andrew Miller for this. Andrew, what is the State of the Union?
Yeah, well, I think what Biden was really trying to accomplish here is kind of like a reset of his presidency. He's had one of the most disastrous inaugural years in U.S. history, probably the most disastrous inaugural year in U.S. history. So he's trying to find what few bright spots he can and make them look brighter. So it's actually, I guess, to start out really telling what he didn't say. He did not mention the catastrophic Afghanistan withdrawal from last summer. Anthony Fauci didn't come up at all. He never used the phrase build back better. Instead, he focused on America's response to the invasion of Ukraine and then spent the second half of it looking on the economy. Although really that's kind of a theme running throughout of it. Is just him trying to cover up how disastrous his economic policies are going have been. In the first half, when he's talking about Ukraine, he's mainly focusing on the sanctions that America's put on Russia, the oil that he's released from the strategic reserves, and the troops he's deployed to Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, and Romania. Now, no one, including Joe Biden, believes that any of those sanctions, oil releases, or troop deployments are going to save Ukraine and defeat Putin. But it is going to hurt Russia's economy, kind of in punishment for what they did. Although it's also going to hurt our economy as well. Between these sanctions and the disruptions that the invasion of Ukraine has caused, analysts are projecting that there's probably going to be gasoline's probably going to cost between $4 and $5 a gallon by next month, depending on what part of the country you live in. And so that's going to be something that's really going to squeeze Americans because of Biden letting this Russian invasion happen in the first place. And so in order to try to kind of allay fears from that, he, in the second half of his State of the Union, he really focused on his infrastructure bill and his American Rescue Act, which is basically creating between the two of them $3 trillion out of nothing. And so going to make inflation much worse as well. He cited 17 Nobel laureates who claim that his infrastructure bill is actually going to bring down inflation by solving the supply chain shortages. I don't know what Nobel laureates he found, because basically any fourth grader who thinks about it for a little bit can tell you that making more dollars out of nothing makes all dollars worth less. The value of the economy is the value of the economy. No, slicing it more ways is going to just make each slice a little smaller.
Yeah, I think any clear-eyed economist is understands that pouring the gasoline of government spending onto the raging fire of inflation is a move that will only increase costs for all Americans, and as you said, lower the value of the dollars. Really bizarre there. In the address, we also saw Biden making a show, at least, of attempting to move the Democratic Party more toward the center. With, you know, we saw this with his talk about the need to secure the border and about how COVID no longer needs to control our lives. Also with his rebuke of the defund the police movement. In all those areas, Biden seemed to be at least giving an appearance that he's trying to pull the leftist party more toward the center. What do you make of that?
I really think that's kind of election year posturing. You're coming into midterm elections this fall. He's had one of the most disastrous presidencies in history so far. Two huge foreign policy failures between Afghanistan and Ukraine. Runaway inflation, out of control immigration. And he's starting to realize that it's just Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and a fringe movement around her who wants open borders and defund the police. Most Americans are actually more concerned about rising crime. Actually, I think rising crime and open borders are the two issues that Biden polls lowest in, and his approval ratings are pretty low overall. And so he's definitely, despite what those Nobel laureates say, he knows inflation's going to get worse. He knows gas prices are going to go up. He doesn't need, if crime goes up as well, he's not going to have much of a chance of being reelected. So he does look like he is going to move a little towards the center on border security and on policing. He also was pushing two big bills, the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, which would basically give every state a federal right to universal mail-in ballots and reduce the amount of scrutiny of those ballots to actually make sure they're legitimate. And so I think that's another thing he's really pushing in the coming up election. Because if he knows if gas prices go up and the inflation gets worse and the Russia things embarrasses him, he needs to try to get a few more votes by cracking down on crime and illegal immigration a little bit. But more importantly than that, he needs to legalize the fraud that happened in the 2020 election if he's going to have any chance at maintaining power.
Could you explain the significance of all this in terms of Bible prophecy?
Yeah, well, I think one of the articles we can put in the show notes is entitled A Nation Destroying Presidency. It's by our executive editor, Mr. Stephen Fleury, that goes through prophecies in Daniel 8 about an Antiochus figure that actually hijacks the American government from within. Our editor-in-chief identified that all the way back in 2012, 2013 as Joe Biden's boss, Barack Obama. And really a lot of the disasters you see in the Biden administration right now are being orchestrated by Barack Obama, who's being even bolder than he was when he was in office. Because when Obama was in office, he got blamed for everything that happened. Now he's kind of got Biden as this fall guy that he doesn't necessarily care as much about his reputation. But you can see that a lot of these policies are a deliberate attack prophesied in Daniel 8 on America from the inside. So the rising gas prices, the runaway inflation, the rising crime, the out-of-control border, immigrants coming across the border, the foreign policy debacles in Ukraine and Afghanistan, they're not as much a result of just political incompetence as many conservatives think. A lot of these things are really unfolding exactly to how what the radical left wants in America, especially some of these economic problems that were almost a way to force America away from oil and gas to be able to like reduce their standard of living and create a more equitable world. Barack Obama has made several comments on that front, how it's not fair that America has a higher standard of living in Indonesia, and we kind of both need to move towards the middle.
A Nation Destroying Presidency is the name of that article by Mr. Stephen Fleury. We will include a link to that in our show notes for today's program. Thanks very much for that, Andrew. We'll take a quick break now, and when we come back, we'll discuss the way pressure on Russia is driving it closer to China and some alarming developments with Iran's nuclear program. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
In response to Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine, the Western world is unleashing just a stunning array of sanctions on Russia. The world's largest shipping companies have discontinued shipping to and from Russian ports. Visa and MasterCard confirmed that they've blocked Russian organizations from their payment networks. Even oil firms such as BP, Shell, and Equinor have cut ties with Russian partners. There's also been a totally unprecedented asset and transaction freeze of the Russian central bank. And then maybe most significant is that seven of Russia's biggest banks have been removed from SWIFT. That's the financial messaging infrastructure that functions as kind of the bloodline for the global financial system. But the truth is that expelling Russia from SWIFT may not leave the nation as isolated as the West hopes. And that's thanks largely to China. To learn more about this, we'll go once again to Abe Blundo.
Yeah, this, just like we saw with other things that have the United States and the West have done, is the cure is worse than the disease, and that these sanctions might actually backfire in a pretty astounding way. As you mentioned, by removing Russia out of SWIFT, they are going to have to try to find a work around those sanctions. And so a lot of experts, including JP Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon, Bloomberg, a lot of other major economists, they're warning that the United States actually overreached on their sanctions. And this is actually going to push Russia and China together to create a alternative to SWIFT. So China's actually been building one for years. And as Bloomberg points out, the whole reason why the United States can even impose these sanctions is because they're the global reserve currency, but also because the number of banks that use SWIFT. So if a lot of worldwide banks moved over to an alternative system, then SWIFT would basically be useless. And this new payment system would need a new reserve currency to back it. And so they're warning that by actually moving Russia from SWIFT, this is actually sparking just a revolution in how the whole world economy is functioning.
So how do you expect Russia and China to make this alternative to SWIFT happen? And how long do you think we should expect, you know, it to take before it's unveiled?
Yeah. So basically, in order to create this this alternative system, they would have to merge what Russia uses. It's the Russian system for transfer of financial messages. They would have to merge that with the Chinese system, which is called cross-border interbank payment system. So if they merge those together, you would have a sizable part of the world's economy now functioning on a different system. And then the other side of that is they would have to, the most important part is they'd have to draw Europe into that system. If European transactions in energy went from US dollar transactions to yen or whatever this new system uses, that would pretty much collapse the whole economic system as we know it. And so in terms of time, this will take some time to do, but if the US economy is hammered with stagflation and all these other forces, you could see a panic start in the international scene and a lot of nations start flocking to this alternative system.
And could you explain the prophetic significance of these developments?
Yeah, this is something that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has been warning about for years, and it's a prophecy found in Isaiah 23 that in these end times, Gentile nations would make a mart of nations, and that would be an alternative economic trade bloc that would oppose the United States and the traditional global order we've seen since the end of World War II. And so this trade bloc includes Russia, China, and Europe. And so this is a key prophecy to happen, because this is actually at the heart of what starts the Great Tribulation, which is such a significant prophecy. And so this, the removing of Russia from SWIFT and this alternative system is what might spark this mart of nations to really come together in record time.
Abe has written an article about this. It's called Where Western Sanctions Against Russia Are Leading, and that'll be up on thetrumpet.com very soon, so please keep an eye out for that. Thanks very much for that, Abe. We'll take a look now at Iran, which the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency has just announced that he'll soon be visiting. To tell us about the purpose of this trip, we'll go back to Brent.
Yeah, this is a really important trip because it comes, I think, at the business end of these nuclear negotiations for Iran's nuclear program. The word on the street is, at least across Twitter, on people that are pretty well informed, that this is the final visit from the IAEA to Iran to work out some secret side deals between the IAEA and verification of Iran's nuclear program that probably won't be discussed with the world powers that are about to sign a deal. There are some outstanding details that Iran has never fessed up on, why there's highly enriched uranium found at certain sites. They're not telling the IAEA about this, and nobody else knows. But it's that issue, and then how compliance of this new deal that is about to be worked out is going to be verified by the International Atomic Energy Agency. That needs to be worked out between the IAEA and Iran. So just think about this. The last time the 2015 deal was worked out, you had world powers basically outsourcing the verification of that Iran was keeping to its end of the deal to the IAEA. Iran talked to the IAEA and said, we'll do this. And then the IAEA told the rest of the world, it's fine, we've got it covered. You don't need to know about Iran's nuclear weapons program. At least we'll verify it. Now, Iran, since that time, hasn't fessed up to the IAEA about bad things they've done. But it looks like they're probably not going to do that. And if they do, it'll just be held close to the chest of the head of that organization. But I think that the big point is that nuclear negotiations are probably going to end this week, and it's going to be culminating with this visit of Grossi, the head of the IAEA, to Iran.
I understand that this news comes just as the IAEA has just announced some alarming data about the amount of enriched uranium that Iran has now created. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so they've got 15 times the legal limit that they agreed upon in the 2015 deal. So that's quite a lot. Back in the lead up to the 2015 deal, Iran had enriched uranium to 20% purity. Now they're enriching up to 60% purity. and a lot of it. They have 3/4 of the amount that they would need to enrich to 90%, which would make it weapons grade enough to use in a nuclear weapon. Should they choose to do that, that'll take a few weeks. So they're only a few weeks away from, that's called nuclear breakout. And this is just an interesting report that here are the same organization that's about to go to Iran to give Iran the stamp back to world powers negotiating with Iran that a nuclear deal is fine, is reporting about the transgressions of the Iranians. And the Iranians regularly say the reason that we are back negotiating is because we decided to use nuclear blackmail and reach to 60%. They're not trying to hold back at this point. They're hoping that it buys them a deal in the end.
Very alarming to see them proceeding despite that, you know, those trespasses there. Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has called the Iran nuclear deal the worst foreign policy blunder in American history. Can you explain just why it's so disastrous and place it in the context of Bible prophecy?
Yeah, well, I think it's about to be worse. This next deal is far worse than the first one that was negotiated in 2015. Iran gets all the money that they want. All the sanctions will come down. There was a leak of the sanctioned individuals that will no longer be sanctioned. This is everyone associated with the Ayatollah, everyone associated with the IRGC. The IRGC is the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. They fund, they equip, that's Qasem Soleimani, everyone knows him, the bad guy. His group and his organization is a terrorist entity designated as such by the Trump administration. That's going to be, that will come down as part of this deal. And so Iran gets lots of money and the sunset clauses will remain, meaning that in a few years, legally, Iran can have a nuclear weapons program. It's basically going back to the 2015 deal without buying the world another 10 years, which the first deal was meant to do. Buy Iran, buy the world 10 years before Iran can get to a bomb. Now we're 6 years down the line. So now we're buying the world 4 years before Iran can get to the bomb. And still, it gets all the money that it wants, access to world powers. And what I think is happening right now is all this discussion about Ukraine, and this is, I'm not to downplaying what's going in Ukraine at all, but the reason, one of the reasons that Putin can push Ukraine and that everybody's worried about whether he's going to stop is because Putin's a nuclear power. Russia's a nuclear power. He has this deterring effect of forceful attacks against him because you never know if he's going to use a nuke. And at the same time that's happening, we're going to have a new nuclear deal that's going to be worked out with Iran and brokered by the United States and Russia. And so here we are, the world is up in arms at Russia, Russia, bad, bad, bad. And they're about to sign a deal with the Iranians to give them a bomb that would help them use that as part of its arsenal that it can kind of push at the rest of the world by threatening to use a nuclear weapon on them, which I find that absolutely stunning. I think next week during this program, I'm going to be discussing that the world has just signed a new nuclear deal with Iran and all the sanctions are gone or about to be gone and they're going to get lots of money and people are still going to be talking about Ukraine and they should be talking about Ukraine, but we shouldn't neglect what's happening and what will happen under the cover of Ukraine with Iran. What we expect from Iran is a foreign policy based on push, and a foreign policy based on push is, that's what the Bible says Iran will do. That will be greatly enhanced when they have, or if they're on the verge of, a nuclear weapon, which this deal will not stop Iran from getting that nuclear weapon. If people want to understand more about this and our forecast for Iran, they need to read The King of the South.
We will include a link to the King of the South booklet in the show notes for today's episode. Really appreciate you explaining why this is just such a sobering and significant development there, Brent. For the next story, we'll take a look at France, where President Emmanuel Macron has announced that he'll be running for re-election. For this, we'll go back to David.
Thank you, Jeremiah. On Thursday, President Emmanuel Macron announced his re-election bid by publishing a 1,000-word letter to several newspapers in France, just basically saying that there's more work for him to do, that they did a pretty good job right now. But I think what's interesting is if he does win, he'd be the first French leader in about two decades to win a second term. And it seems like with the war going on in Ukraine that he has some better chances because a lot of his major competition was seen as pretty friendly to Russia. So it's kind of a very advantageous time to announce this kind of bid. In fact, President Putin just gave him a call about the Ukraine war to discuss it. And Macron came out saying that basically that the world should just expect the worst to come yet.
So what can you tell us about Macron's leadership up until now and what that would indicate for the future of France if his re-election bid is successful?
So what we've seen from Macron is that he's very pro boosting the military spending. He was a critic of the UN, a critic of NATO, basically saying that the EU has to be independent of reliance on the United States for military support. So he's a big proponent of that. We've seen him to be a very strong supporter of Germany. He even supported the Nord Stream 2 pipeline that Germany was building with Russia, just showing you that the support for Germany and what it wants goes beyond even just the military, but even through the economy. We know that pipeline is a big instigator of this conflict with Russia and Ukraine as well, just making Europe less dependent on gas going through Ukraine. So we've seen that. We've also seen that he's a strong supporter of the Catholic Church, which is very important when it comes to biblical prophecy, knowing that we're going to have a very strong resurrection of a Holy Roman Empire. So the Catholic Church is very much involved. So with him winning, if he does win, you would just expect the same, a very strong support and ally to Germany, a powerful leader on the world scene that is going to do whatever he can to make the EU more independent of the United States.
And what literature would you recommend for listeners who would like to better understand this in the prophetic context?
Well, I think if you want to learn more specifically about Macron, Mr. Gerald Fleury, the editor-in-chief, had an article titled "France is Resurrecting the Holy Roman Empire" in the March 2020 Trumpet issue. And if you've already read that, then of course our booklet, Germany and the Holy Roman Empire from Gerald Fleury, would be a great place to learn more about these prophecies and how the Holy Roman Empire is going to be back on the scene.
We'll be sure to include links to both of those. Thanks very much for that, David. And for our final story of the show today, we're going to look at California, where the drought has again grown dire after two record dry months. To bring us up to speed on this, we'll go once again to Andrew.
Yeah, the snowpack in the mountains in California is about two-thirds of what it normally is, and that's just due to the fact that they've gotten almost no snow, even in the mountains this winter, which is really concerning news for anyone who lives there, because even in normal times, in the summer, most of the water for those western regions, California, Nevada, Arizona, places like that, comes from rivers fed by glacial runoff. So if those snowpacks are down, not only are you not going to get any rain this summer, but even the rivers could go dry. And you're already seeing this in the fact that, I mean, the cattle herd is shrinking faster than it has at any point in a decade, as people either, as cattle either starve or are sold off because they just don't have the water to keep the grass growing for them. That's actually one of the reasons meat prices are so high right now. I mean, one, you've got the inflation we talked about earlier, which affects all food. But for meat, it's like America's cattle producing regions are just going dry. And really, to put this in perspective, they actually just before this news story about the ice packs broke, they did a really comprehensive study examining the growth rings of trees in the western United States back millennia, and have found, because you know the tree ring, it grows wider when it's water and narrower when there's not, right, and found that this drought has been going on for 22 years, pretty much since the turn of the millennium, 2000. And the past 22 years have been the driest 22 period in Californian history in the past 1,200 years. So the last time it was this dry in California, Charlemagne was being crowned in Europe, and the Mayan Empire was collapsing due to the drought. the drought wouldn't have affected old Charlemagne too much. He was on the other side of the world. But the Mayans, they were down there in Mexico, and a lot of them say that this drought is what ended their civilization, and it's just as bad as now, and could possibly get worse here in the near future.
Really gives us some perspective there that it's been so long since it's been this intense. Andrew has written an article that's up on thetrumpet.com right now. It's called "Is America Headed for a Dust Bowl?" And this article takes a thorough look at Leviticus 26 and several related passages. So please check that out to understand the significance of these weather conditions in the prophetic context. Thanks very much for that, Andrew. We are now coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Please email any questions or comments you may have about today's episode to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks very much to our panel today, Andrew Miller, David V. Hill, Abraham Blondeau, and Brent Noctegal. And thanks very much to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. We'll leave you today with these words from Alexander Graham Bell. Concentrate all your thoughts upon the work at hand. The sun's rays do not burn until brought to a focus. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.